All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231, and it is August 31st. And it's sort of a noteworthy week because you're getting your first test in here, not in lecture, but in lab practicums. Probably some people have taken the practicum already. And in that regard, I want to make sure if you didn't get an email, what do you know about that? There's some videos here. Here's a histology flash quiz like we did in my labs as well as in lecture. So you can watch that, practice labeling various slides, epithelia, connective tissue, phases of mitosis. And then here are some tutorials on the model of the integument. I know I was a little rushed in my lab, so this will help you really get up to speed on that integument model. All right, so please check these out if you wish. The other thing that I want to bring your attention to, let's see, this is Bio 231, right? And we have class from 10:30 till 11:50. All right, so 10:30 to 11:50 according to the syllabus. And there are a lot of people that cut out early last time and really disrupted the class. And so I want to make sure that if you continue to do that, so, you know, I'm going to actually count you as being absent and you're going to get dropped from the class. And usually I don't mind if somebody has to leave early as long as you're quiet about that. But there are students that are trying to listen to lecture, get a good grade in here, and they just can't if 20 or 15 or 20 people get up and cause a ruckus before the class is over. So please be courteous to your fellow students. Right, so don't leave class early. If you have a question about that, come talk to me. But here you see it clearly in the schedule of classes. We go to 11:50. All right, so we were talking about the integument last time. And that, of course, is the largest organ system in your body. And what are the two main layers of your integument? Epidermis. And dermis, right? Epidermis is superficial, it means on top of the dermis. And then besides those two main layers, there are some accessory structures. Who can tell me the names of some accessory structures? Hair? Glands, yeah, I got a bunch of sweat glands. And nails. There's some sensory receptors and nerves. Sensory receptors for touch, pain, temperature. And what else? It is the ab muscle, a little muscle, erector pili muscle. Right, so that pretty much covers everything. So let's just review real quick some of the layers right here. All right, so we are looking at... All right, so here is just a free edge. So there's a free space that's just outside your body. So this is skin. And then here I see a nice basement membrane. So from the basement membrane all the way up to this apical surface, what kind of tissue is this right here? Is it connective tissue or what? Bone? No, it's an epithelium. It's an epithelium. Now what kind of epithelium is that? It's a stratified squamous, right? Stratified because there's many layers of cells right here. And it's squamous because the cells in the apical region are flat, so they're squamous cells. So what do you have to know? You got to make sure that you know the layers in thick skin, which we see on the left-hand side, compared to thin skin. All right, so let's look at this particular diagram. The layer that contains living cells that are proliferating, they're undergoing mitosis, they're pushing newly formed cells up to the surface. That's the stratum basale. All right, and then this next layer right here, the cells are kind of transforming their shape a little bit because of desmosomes. They're getting a little spiky in appearance. So that's the stratum spinosum. Yeah, stratum spinosum. Okay, and then this layer right here, if we were to really zoom in, if we have a nice microscope slide, we could see that these cells are filled with prekeratin granules. And so this is the stratum granulosum. And then since this is thick skin, I see a little transparent layer right superficial to the granulosum, that's the stratum, lucidum, and then this large thick layer right here is the stratum, corneum, and these cells are dead. So in this example over here, we have thin skin, nice basement membrane, so stratum basale, stratum spinosum, stratum granulosum, and stratum corneum. It's missing the stratum lucidum. So make sure you know the order of these different layers, especially for the practicum. Well, just like the epidermis has layers, so does the dermis. So the deep layer of the dermis, you can tell what kind of tissue is the deep layer of the dermis. What do you see in here? Look at these. Okay. All right. It's called the reticular layer, but that's sort of a misnomer because the kind of tissue it is a lot stronger than reticular tissue. Because if it was reticular tissue, probably just by putting your clothes on and getting in the car, you'd rip your skin apart because reticular fibers are very weak. All right. So that wouldn't work. So this right here, these are the strongest of the fibers. What's the strongest of the fibers? Collagen, right? So this is dense, irregular connective tissue, but the deep layer nonetheless is called reticular. All right, the superficial layer of the dermis is called the papillary layer. That's areolar connective tissue, and it's named because of these dermal papillae, which are projections up into the epidermis. And you have the vascular plexes in these dermal papillae, which help nourish all of these cells of the epidermis. Because remember, the epidermis is avascular all by itself. Okay. Now, in the study guide that I gave you for the test, which is this one right here, this is figure 5.3, I believe. Check in your books if that's 5.3. That's on your list. And it was not included in that pamphlet that I gave you for test number one. All right, it's in the list, but the figure was absent, I've noticed. You do have it online, so you can go ahead and print it out if you wish. All right, but I've asked production to make a copy, and by Wednesday I hope to have a copy for everybody in here. So don't forget to study this figure just because it's not in hard copy in the study guide. It's in the study guide list, but not the hard copy. All right, but we've covered this one already. All right, so make sure you know the layers of the epidermis and layer of the dermis. That's a deep layer. The papillary layer is areolar connective tissue. The reticular layer is what? Dense, irregular CT. All right, skin color. Well, skin color comes in all kinds of different colors, and even comes in blotchy or more uniform. And skin color is due to compounds we call pigments. So any kind of chemical that absorbs light, I guess we did talk about this, so it's coming back to me a little bit, okay, is a chemical that can absorb light. And the more pigments your skin has, the more protected you are from sunlight, because sunlight contains ultraviolet light that's very damaging. It can damage chromosomes, can turn skin into cancerous cells, right? And so what's the name that produces the pigment that protects us from sunlight? Yeah, melanocytes. And so that tells you the name of the chemical which protects you from sunlight. That is melanin, and it's produced by melanocytes. Moles and age spots increase as you get older, okay, because of an increased number of melanocytes in a certain part of your body, right? So we kind of change color a little bit as we get older. Freckles are an increased melanin production in some localized area in some people that just have that inherited from their parents. And here's an interesting condition. It's an abnormal condition. I wouldn't really call it a disease state, but people have to be very careful, and it's called albinism. People with albinism have an inability to produce any melanin, any place in their body. All right, so you can imagine what it's like for them to go out in sunlight. It is very damaging to them. Right, so we probably don't have many people with albinism here in Los Angeles because the sun is so bright, and maybe I mentioned this last time. Where would you expect to see a larger population of this inherited abnormal condition? Someplace way north where the sun isn't so bright, like Seattle, maybe Minneapolis, right? And so these people can go outside without immediately turning into a crisp. And of course, there is no way to change that condition because you're just born with that inability to produce melanin. There's an enzyme that's missing. Cyanosis. Does anybody know cyanosis? What color does that produce? Kind of a bluish cast to people. Blood that is oxygenated is bright red. But when oxygen is absorbed out of the blood, it changes color and it turns a little bit blue. And so people that are in respiratory distress, or maybe their heart isn't working properly, or maybe they even have a malformation of their vascular system and they're not oxygenating their blood properly, will have a bluish cast to them. And so that's called cyanosis. And of course, that's one of the things that we look for immediately as soon as somebody's born, is what color their skin is. Because if it's blue, then that's a nice hint that something is very wrong with their lungs or cardiovascular system, right? And it actually goes into a score that's used to score the health of a baby as soon as it's born. Does anybody know what that's called? That's called an Apgar score, right? So we look at all kinds of different things. Skin color is one of those important things that go into that score. Another condition which changes skin color is called jaundice. And this is not blue, and it's not kind of reddish like freckles. This is what kind of color? A really bright yellow. I don't have an example for you right here, but jaundice is a condition where somebody's liver is failing, or for some reason too many red blood cells are being broken down in their body, and it overloads their liver. So there is a pigment in blood, and it's also it's primarily used to carry oxygen in our body, but it is also red when it's oxygenated. It turns blue when it's deoxygenated, and as it's cleared from your body, it's turned into a compound called biliverdin and bilirubin, and these are yellow compounds. So if your body has too many red blood cells being broken down or liver damage, then these compounds will accumulate in your body and just give your whole body a very bright yellow kind of feature. The whites of a person's eyes will be yellow. Their fingernails will be yellow. Okay? So maybe if somebody has liver cancer or chemotherapy that's very toxic to the liver, they can become jaundiced as a result of that. And probably we all have birthmarks of some kind on our body. These are dark spaces on our body. And this is just a localized increase in vascularity in some small part of your body. And remember, blood is red when it's oxygenated, so it's just going to look a little bit darker compared to other kinds of skin that you have nearby. Okay. There's another condition I don't have on your list right here, right, that kind of inhibits the production of melanin, but not all over your body, just in a little spot. Does anybody know what that's called? So you could be just natural skin color compared to your parents all over your body, but you might have a bright white spot on your cheek or your forehead or your arm or whatever. And that's called vitiligo. All right, and vitiligo is an autoimmune disease where a person's own body attacks the melanin, and in that one area, melanin isn't being produced. So, for instance, if you have really dark skin, but vitiligo, maybe on your cheek, what do you have to be concerned with? If you go outside, no place in your body is going to get sunburned except what? That really bright spot right there. Okay, so you got to wear a hat or sunblock or something on that spot so it doesn't get sunburned. Okay. All right, well, let's look at some accessory structures. Hair are thread-like structures consisting of keratinocytes, but the arrangement of these keratinocytes, instead of being flat sheets like we find in the stratum corneum, are arranged in columns that grow out of the skin. And the shaft lies above the surface of the skin, the root and below, and the bulb are below the surface of the skin. And everything below the surface of the skin is what we call the hair follicle. And there are melanocytes as well in the hair follicle that give hair its particular color. And red hair is a result of melanin plus incorporation of a little bit of an iron molecule in there. So, all right, so here are some of the accessory structures that we find in the skin. All right, so what layer is the cursor going over right now? Stratum basale. Okay, and hair follicles are a reservoir of stratum basale cells. All right, well, you know, there's something happening a lot in a bunch of neighborhoods, and that is we have a bunch of fires going on. So let's just talk about the skin a little bit in respect to burns. There are different degrees of burns. If you get a very mild burn, which maybe singes some of the hairs, right, the hair shaft right here, but doesn't damage the deeper cells, right, that's what we call a first-degree burn. And it might produce a little bit of reddening. These capillaries in the dermal papillae might swell up and leak a little bit, but that's not too bad. That's not a very dangerous burn. But there are pain receptors that are damaged, and so that will feel painful. But if you only get a first-degree burn, you're pretty lucky, right? Well, and a second-degree burn is when the top layer of the cells, even the stratum basale right here, can be damaged, right? So they die, and these capillaries get very leaky as a result, and that forms a blister underneath the epidermis, right? That's what we call a second-degree burn. That's very painful, and that's, again, the person that gets a second-degree burn, in my opinion, is pretty lucky because their integument is still continuous, right? They don't have to worry about the two main causes of disease, of more significant burns. And what are the two really significant things you have to be concerned with a burn? Dehydration, when you start to lose a lot of fluid, as well as infection, right? So as long as those blisters don't burst, you don't have to worry about infection. All right, but now let's just say that somebody burns down to this layer right here where I have the cursor moving across. All right, so all of the epidermis has been burned away, turned into charcoal, all right, at this level right here, right through this papillary layer. Now, is that person lucky or unlucky, would you say? I heard unlucky. Well, you know what? That person is still lucky, for the following reason, okay? Where does the epidermis grow from? What layer? The stratum basale, right? So here we see it curving around, and when it gets to a hair follicle, where does it go? It goes deep down into the dermis, even down into the reticular layer of the dermis. So here is the stratum basale, deep down in the reticular layer of the dermis, and what are these cells right here? Are they alive or dead? They're alive, and what are they doing? They are proliferating. They're undergoing mitosis, right? So that if somebody is burned to this layer right here, of course, we have to be concerned immediately about dehydration and infection, and as long as we can stabilize the patient, guess what's going to happen? These cells, since they're growing, can grow back the skin of that individual, right? Because these cells are what we call a reservoir of epidermal cells. They will grow back. So that's why I think that person is pretty lucky. Now, what happens if somebody's burned and their skin is burned all the way to the very deepest layer of the reticular layer of the dermis, maybe into the hypodermis? Now, what can you tell me about that person? That's really unlucky, right? Because not only do they have to worry about dehydration and infection, but their skin is never going to grow back because, why? The stratum basale is destroyed everywhere, all right? And then what do they need? They need grafts, right? They need grafts in order to repopulate the integument in that part of their body. All right, so that's why it's so important to know all of these different layers. Clinically, it's very, very important for staging cancer, to know how to treat burn patients, et cetera, et cetera. So pay really close attention to layers. So here is a nice erector pili muscle that's attached to the hair follicle that contracts when you're anxious or when you're cold. And that pulls the hair straight up and forms a little goosebump. It pulls the hair up to the surface as well. All right, and you can see some other accessory structures. Like here is a gland associated with a hair follicle. This is a sebaceous gland, and it secretes an oily material, right, that helps protect you from dehydration and moistens your skin. And over here is an eccrine sweat gland. And here's the duct that goes up to the surface that produces sweat. That's the watery kind of solution all over your body. There's another kind of sweat gland that I don't see on this diagram that's found in the axillary region and inguinal region. It's bigger than an eccrine sweat gland. Does anybody know what kind of gland that is? That's an apocrine gland, right? Apocrine sweat gland. And you find that, for instance, I told you, the axilla and inguinal region. And you have a couple other modified sweat glands. Mammary glands are modified sweat glands that don't secrete sweat, but what? Milk for nourishing a baby. And you also have some sweat glands in your ear canals that don't secrete sweat necessarily, but a very thick waxy material that keeps your, there's a membrane inside your ear that you use to hear, and it should remain pliable and loose so that it can vibrate when sound goes past it, and that prevents your eardrum or your tympanic membrane from drying out and cracking. And that's called a ceruminous gland. So you have a number of different kinds of glands. Sebaceous with a hair follicle, eccrine for sweat, apocrine. I'm not sure anybody knows the reason why. Ceruminous glands in your ear, all right, mammary glands for nourishing young. Other kinds of accessory structures that we see for sensation, here's a nice Pacinian corpuscle for deep pressure, and then we have a Meissner's corpuscle for very light touch, and as a matter of fact, people can use these Meissner's corpuscles because they're so sensitive to light touch, they can even read with these sensory nerve endings. So what kind of type would somebody be reading with their Meissner's corpuscles? Like Braille, right? If they don't have eyes, they can still read by feeling little bumps on a piece of paper. Right. Okay. All right, so that's mostly it for the integument. Nails. I got to go over nails a little bit. All right, where's a picture of a nail? Here's a good picture of a nail. All right, so what kind of section does this look like right here? Does that look like a transverse section or a coronal section? What's another name for coronal? Frontal. Is that a frontal section? And what's the last kind? Sagittal. So don't forget, put your body into anatomic position. My fingers are pointing inferiorly, right? And this is right smack down the middle of somebody's finger, so that's a nice sagittal section. That's a nice sagittal section. All right, so here is the free edge of the nail. The nail is growing out from the finger. The body of the nail is what we can see. And the nail is made out of keratinocytes as well, just like hair and skin. But these keratinocytes even produce more keratin. And the arrangement of these cells is not in columns like in hair, but in flat plates that are connected together by desmosomes. And since there's more keratin in these keratinocytes, it's what? It's a harder material. So these protect your fingertips from trauma, right? It's also, what are nails also used for? Yeah, picking things up, like catching prey, right? If many mammals catch prey, like birds have talons, right? And for protection, self-defense. Okay, now where does the nail grow from? Here is something called the nail root. The nail root is the part of the body of the nail that's underneath the proximal nail fold. But that's not where the nail really is growing from. The nail really is formed already. Where it's forming is way up over here. This is the nail matrix. So if you ever see a question, where is the nail growing from? You might be tempted to say the root, but the correct answer is what? The matrix of the nail, right? So this is the proliferating area right here. It's highly vascular. As a matter of fact, this whole area right here is highly vascular. And you can actually see a little part of this area through the nail. This is what we call the lanula right here. And then you have the cuticle. The real name for the cuticle is the epinetium. And that's just some skin that's coming off of the proximal nail fold. Okay, so maybe some of you have damaged a body of a nail, maybe even damaged the nail root, but will the nail grow back? Yeah. Okay, because as long as you don't damage the nail matrix, it will grow back pretty quickly, maybe a couple months, right? But if the nail matrix is damaged, right, if it's destroyed, then what happens to your fingertip? Well, it's never going to have a nail again there, okay? So I know a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, but I've known some people to get a fungus infection underneath the nail, and if it's a really severe condition, they actually remove the whole nail out and treat that infection because it's hard to get fungicides through the body of a nail, but then you have access to this growing layer right here. And even with the nail removed, during treatment, it does what? It starts to grow back. So that's not such a big deal. All right, so that's something about nails. The functions, don't forget your functions of the integument system. What prevents water loss and infections? Melanin absorbs ultraviolet radiation. Hair is a heat insulator. Eyebrows and lashes protect your eyes from debris getting into your eyeballs. Even in your nose and ears, there are hair to prevent entry of foreign objects. All right. Temperature regulation is very important. When you become overheated, when your body temperature is above 98.6, blood vessels going to the skin vasodilate. So they take a lot of blood from the deep structures of your body, take it to your skin. So the temperature of your skin increases and you radiate more temperature out of your body, cooling your body down. And when you're cold, blood vessels vasoconstrict. That's okay. Vasoconstrict, so less blood goes to the surface of your skin and you maintain core body temperature that way. So heat transfer is an important part of your skin. Vitamin D production also takes place in the skin. There are certain compounds that need to be converted into an inactive form of vitamin D, and that utilizes ultraviolet light. That's a very high energy wavelength. And then your liver can convert this inactive form into an active form. All right, and then you can absorb calcium in your diet. And a lot of people are concerned with aging, because guess what happens to your skin when it ages? Does it change? Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So why is that? The main reason is because of changes in blood vessels that go to your skin. They get fewer and far between. They carry less blood, so that means that the integument itself can't recover from injury very much, right? Because it's lacking oxygen and nutrients. So most of the age-related effects on the skin is a result of decreased vascularity. And the thing that can beat blood vessels up the most, guess what it is? I probably mentioned that is the sun, right? So that can prematurely age somebody's skin. All right, so when you lose blood supply to the skin, we're talking the dermis in particular, the skin becomes, what, thinner and more transparent. And it's more easily damaged by sunlight as a result of that. Decreased collagen production in the dermis, in particular the reticular layer of the dermis, which means that the skin can be more easily damaged. And once it is damaged, it just takes a long time to heal as we get older. All right, so repairs much more slowly. And not only collagen fibers, but elastic fibers and reticular fibers. So without those elastic fibers, our skin has a tendency to get saggy as we get older and wrinkly, right? And in order for glands to work properly, they need to have a good blood supply. And when the blood supply is decreased to a gland, then it doesn't secrete sweat as much, right? So you have a tendency to overheat. You can't regulate body temperature as you get older, right? Like your grandma and grandpa, you got to be really careful of them. Like it's been so hot the last couple of days, right? They shouldn't get out and outside and work in the yard. Just take it easy because they can go into hyperthermia very, very easily because they just can't sweat as much as a younger person. And their sebaceous glands don't have the same activity as well. So that means that if they have dry skin typically because those sebaceous glands aren't working as well as they used to. And melanocyte activity can either increase or decrease, and so you can get age spots, you can get white spots on your skin, okay? And of course, as we get older, right, the blood supply to hair follicles diminishes, right? So the activity of melanocytes in the hair follicles decreases, and people end up with graying hair or white hair. And those are just things that happen as we get older. Now, I have kind of an interesting question, at least in my mind anyway. All right, so here's a picture of the skin. All right, so as we get older, these blood vessels in the hair follicle, all right, become less active. So this hair follicle, the melanocytes in the hair follicle don't produce as much melanin. So as the hair grows out, it's going to be whitish or silvery or gray or whatever. All right, but what about a person's skin? Okay, why is it that people with a heritage from, say, Africa, which have very, very dark skin, as these people get older and older and older, what happens to their hair? Does it turn color? Yeah, it turns white or gray. Okay, but what about their skin? Okay, does their skin turn white or gray? Now, why is that? Why do you think that is? Why does somebody's hair turn gray, but not necessarily their whole skin? And it just doesn't mean somebody from Africa, but everywhere, right? People's skin usually doesn't get lighter. Well, what did we say? What is the most important factor for the age-related effects on the skin? What's changing the most? Yeah, it's the blood supply to the skin. So these blood vessels in the hair follicle change, right, are much more sensitive to age than the blood vessels in what? The dermal plexus right here, right? So these still can maintain the health of those melanocytes to protect a person's skin, except maybe in a couple areas. Yeah. Yeah, these blood vessels are being damaged for some reason, okay? And I'm not really sure I know what the mechanism is, but, you know, I just kind of know what I've heard on TV, and that is what? That is related to high levels of testosterone. But why it damages these blood vessels here more than others, I'm not really sure I know why, okay? Yeah.
Can it be related to trauma?
Because
I got stung by a bee on my head when I was young.
Oh, sure, any kind of... Yeah. That could maybe be due to the toxins that damaged blood vessels in that area. But also when you get stung, that triggers an immune response in that particular area. And so maybe your immune system is just more sensitive to chemicals in that part of the body. You know, I don't know which way it is. It probably is due to damage of the blood vessels in that area. Yeah. Okay. That's kind of interesting. Yeah, I never heard that before. Yeah. Ah, yeah, I don't know, because there's just not enough damage to these cells, to these blood vessels right here. So it's kind of a fine line for these hair follicles. Yeah, yeah. So it has to do with these blood vessels right here. Yeah. So who? Oh, vitiligo, yeah. No. I don't know what it could be. Was it developmental? Vitiligo is usually developmental. Ever since it... Yeah. There's no way for me to know. Yeah. Eczema, yeah, could maybe... Yeah. The eczema could be itchy, scaly. Okay. Okay. Here's a sign-in sheet. Please sign it, but don't cut out early. You know, if you have to go someplace, that's fine. I just don't like you disturbing the other students, right, if a whole bunch of you cut out early. All right, so that's pretty much for the integument. Now, does anybody have any questions over the integument, especially, or the histology, because you got that practicum coming up this week? What about SI? Did you guys cover histology and integument? Yes?
Yeah.
Very nice. Good. You did?
We're doing integument today.
Oh, you're doing integument today. Oh, yeah, like maybe after class or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, go ahead, speak up a little bit.
My practice test is going to be on Wednesday.
Oh, the practice test for SDI. Wednesday.
Yeah.
Thursday. And Thursday.
They're going to be different.
So they're a practice test for lecture.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Okay. And somebody had a question regarding SI, and they said, do we have to go to every SI session? You know, or can I miss one or two, or can I go right before a test? And the answer is yes, you certainly can. You don't have to be there every time, the whole time. Attendance is not taken, roll call isn't taken, and just the more time that you go, the more it could help you out, right? So that's all there's to it. So you certainly don't have to be there all the time. All right, so we're going to move on to another chapter. All right, and this is skeletal system. Okay, skeletal tissue. All right, so this week you're going to start this in lab as well after the practicum. And there's a fair amount of information in the skeletal system, but it's kind of fun. And I guess I want to say, and I'm going to say this a number of times, spend a lot of time with your bones and knowing the various pieces of bones because you will learn so much about anatomy just by knowing bones. So, for instance, I have two bones in my forearm. And where's my forearm at again? It's between your elbow and your wrist, right? That's your forearm. And between your elbow and your shoulder, that's your arm. Your arm's only got one bone, but the forearm has got two. The one that is lateral, how do you know which way is lateral? Because it's the one associated with your thumb. The lateral bone is called the radius. Okay, and so if you know the bones, like if you know that bone as being the radius, you also know the name of the nerve that's over here. Guess what the name of that nerve is? That's the? I'll go ahead and say it. I don't even have to teach you that. It's the radial nerve. You've got a blood vessel that goes over there. Guess what the name of that blood vessel is? That's the radial artery right there, right? So just by knowing the bones, what are you learning? You're learning your vascular anatomy. You're learning your neuroanatomy, right? So get really familiar with your bones. And neuroanatomy sometimes is a little bit difficult. So for instance, my temporal bone is right here. Guess what the name of the lobe of the brain is in this region right here? That's the temporal lobe. And I got an occipital bone back here in the back of my head. Guess what the name of the lobe of the brain is right there? Occipital lobe. Right? So there's just a lot of anatomy you learn from knowing your bones. So spend a lot of good extra time with bones. All right, so what are some components of the skeletal system? Well, it's bone. We did talk about that for sure. But there's also cartilage. Cartilage protects the ends of bones, and it can act like a bone in certain parts of your body, but of course it's more flexible and it's lighter. It protects bones, and it can also be a nice light bone in a part of your body. And then there are things that connect bones together to stabilize joints, and these are called ligaments. Right, so ligaments are dense, regular connective tissue, but it's a bone-to-bone connection. There are no muscles attached to ligaments. So, all right, so here are some key features of the skeletal system. What we see, what do we got? Blue right here? More or less? All right. This is hyaline cartilage. We see some cartilages of the nose. Right? We see some cartilage of the rib cage. Is hyaline cartilage. And probably you have a picture in your mind of what hyaline cartilage looks like. What does it not have? It's missing something that we see in the other kinds of cartilage. It has no fibers. Yeah, it has no elastic fibers. Well, it doesn't have elastic fibers and collagen, thick collagen fibers. Right? And it also covers the ends of bones. Elastic cartilages. Right, in our ear, for instance. Of course, we know that's elastic because we can deform our ear. And then a fibrocartilage we have in knee meniscus right here, here and here, the pubic symphysis. And also we have another meniscus in the temporomandibular joint. That's your jaw joint. has a meniscus, kind of similar to what we have in the knee. And then the intervertebral discs that protect the vertebrae are made up of fibrocartilage. So cartilage is part of the skeletal system. All right, so what are the functions of bone? Well, support. A lot of times we'll mention an organ system, and maybe in our mind there's one important function that stands out, but all organs perform many kinds of functions. All right, so I want you to be aware of all the different kinds of functions that bone produces. All right, bone is rigid and strong. It can bear great weight. Cartilage is firm and flexible, like in your nose and ear, rib cage, but it's what? It's a lot lighter than bone. So that's a really nice advantage. It can give shape to the body, but if all the cartilage was in our body was made out of bone, we'd be a lot heavier. It would require a lot more muscle to move us around and a lot more energy as well. Okay, protection. The skull protects our brain. Inside our brain, we don't have any bones. We don't have a lot of connective tissue holding it together. So the skull is like armor plating for our brain. And the rib cage protects our spinal cord. Again, it's armor plating around our spinal cord. And the rib cage, made up of our ribs, what does it produce? Or what does it protect? Sorry, what does it protect? The rib cage. It protects our lungs, which are very important, and our heart and great blood vessels. All right, so these are like armor platings that protect deep structures in our body. Let's see. Also, movement is important because muscles attach to bone, and if there's a muscle that attaches to two different bones, when that muscle contracts, what happens to those bones? They move closer together, right, through some kind of articulation. And some joints have limited motion because there are ligaments that prevent that motion as well. It's just as important. Now here is a real important concept. Bone is an important storage area for a number of different compounds. It's important for storing calcium ions. Right? We know that we need calcium to make strong bones, but there are a number of even more important functions in our body that require calcium. Right? And we couldn't be alive at all without the proper blood levels of calcium. So when your blood calcium decreases, your body goes to bone to get that calcium so that we can stay alive. Even though what happens to bone? It gets weaker when it's decalcified, but that's better than dying, right? Phosphate is also stored in bone, and there are spaces in bone that are used to store fat, and that's just, fat is just a very nice, powerful form of energy in our body. All right, so besides storage, bone is a hematopoietic tissue. This is where red blood cells are produced in the cavities that are deep inside the bone. And the cavities can be filled with yellow bone marrow, which is a storage form of fat, or it can be red bone marrow. And red bone marrow is the kind of marrow that makes red blood cells for us. Okay, so what is a hematopoietic tissue? Hemo is blood. Poietic is producing blood. So bones are important for producing red blood cells in our body, for maintaining a healthy cardiovascular system, and indeed every tissue in your body needs oxygen, right? So bones are important for making sure that your body gets oxygen all over the place. And we talked about red blood cells, I think, already. What's the lifespan of a red blood cell? It's only about 120 days, right? And can you relate that to any of the organelles that are inside a red blood cell? Why does a red blood cell live such a short period of time? Because they don't have a nucleus. They are what we call anucleate. They're anucleate, so they can't readjust their metabolism. They can't regenerate any part of the cell that gets damaged, so red blood cells die pretty quickly, after about 120 days. All right, so what did I tell you? How many red blood cells die every second in your body? Did I tell you that? Yeah, I think about 2.5 million. So the bones have to make 2.5 million red blood cells every second so that you don't become what? So that you don't become anemic, right? That's the condition when you run out of red blood cells. All right, so don't forget about the three types of cartilage. You have hyaline cartilage without fibers. You still have chondrocytes and lacunae. There's a soluble collagen matrix. We call that ground substance. And you find that in the nose, articulations, and in the upper airways. Elastic cartilage is similar to hyaline, but it contains what those branched elastic fibers. And we find that in the epiglottis in the ear. The epiglottis is something that you need to swallow with when we get to the respiratory system. I'll talk about that. And then, of course, the fibrocartilage. That's the toughest kind of cartilage. It has those thick collagen fibers that resist compression, right? Squishing. Compression is squishing. And what's tension? Tension is pulling apart, okay? And torsion is twisting. All right, so collagen does a really good job of doing all of that. All right, so sometimes we talk about bones by their particular shape. And here we can see some different shapes of bones. Some bones are very tubular in nature, like the bone in your arm. That's the humerus right there. We call that a long bone because there's one dimension that the bone is really big at. The other two dimensions are really small. Some bones are flat, like the sternum. That's your breastbone. And other bones are irregular, like vertebrae. It's got a center of mass and then all these bumps sticking out of it. So we call that an irregular bone. And then some bones are what we call short bones, like the bones that make up your wrist, for instance, are short bones. So you should probably know this classification, an example of one bone that is long. All right, now let's zoom in to this region right here. All right, so we're looking at somebody's hand. Whoa, right here. All right, and here is a bone right here. It is not very long because it just makes up part of your finger. What's an anatomical name for finger? Anybody know? That's a digit. The bones that make up a digit are phalanges. All right, so here is a digit right here, and I see three phalanges in this particular digit. Now let's consider this middle phalanx. What is that? What kind of bone does that look like? We don't see it in three dimension, but in your mind's eye, does it look like a flat bone, or an irregular bone, or a short bone, or a long bone? It's a trick question. Okay, it is actually a long bone. All right, so even though it's short, it's still a long bone because why? It is big in one dimension, that is the superior inferior dimension, but right to left and anterior posterior, it's short. All right, so in two dimensions it's very, very small, but in one dimension it's very big, so that makes it a nice long bone, even though it's tiny. So tiny bones still can be long bones. Okay. All right, so here is a good model that you should use to think of bone all the time. And we're going to look at the parts of a long bone. The parts of a long bone. All right, I'm sure this is an exam figure. This won't be on your first test, I don't believe. I don't think this is this chapter on your first test? It's not. Okay. All right. It will be on the next one, and this might even be on the next practicum that you have because it's a really good teaching model of how to think about bone. So here we have a bone. What kind of bone does that look like by shape? Does that look irregular or short or flat or long? It's a long bone. Okay. So we use that as a model, and surrounding every surface of a long bone is a membrane, and we call that the periosteum, right? So osteo means what? Bone. Peri means surrounding. Periosteum is the membrane that surrounds bone. And we see that in this bone right here, there's a big hole. That's what we call a cavity, and we call that the medullary cavity. And there is a membrane that lines every interior space of a bone as well. That's not the periosteum, that's what we call the, do you see down here? It should be here someplace, like right here, that's the endosteum. All right, so that's the lining on the inside of the bone. The lining on the outside is the periosteum. Okay. All right, so every long bone has got two ends. The ends of a bone are what we call the epiphyses. So here's an epiphysis, right? And here is another epiphysis. The one that is closer to some center location in your body is the proximal epiphysis. The one that's more, that's farther away is the distal epiphysis. All right, so the ends of a long bone are the epiphyses. And the middle part, the shaft of a bone, is what we call the diaphysis. So please be aware of that terminology. And if we look at most of the bone in an epiphyses, what does it kind of look like to you, where I have the cursor right now? It's got a bunch of tiny holes in it. All right? It's filled with bony plates that we call trabeculae with spaces all over the place. So we call this spongy bone. Spongy bone is nice because it's strong, but it's a lot lighter compared to if it was solid. All right? Plus, we can put stuff in this space right here. What can we put in these spaces right here? We can put one of two kinds of things. I just mentioned it not too long ago. Okay, it could be bone marrow of some kind. What are the two kinds of bone marrow? Either yellow or red, right? So yellow would be fat, red would be a hematopoietic tissue. All right, so your body doesn't waste these spaces right here. All right, so this is what we call spongy bone. Another kind of bone is what we see right over here. This is what we call compact bone. All right, so in spongy bone, I see all these trabeculae, all these little bony plates, but in this part of the bone, it is solid. All right, so every organ has at least two different spaces. There's a part of the organ that's very close to the surface. We call that the superficial part of the organ, as opposed to what, the deeper part of the organ. The superficial part is what we call the cortex. So here is the cortex of a bone. And all bones have a cortex. And the deeper part is what we call the medulla. Right? So cortical bone is what kind of bone? Cortical bone goes by another name. We call it compact bone. And medullary bone goes by another name. We call it spongy bone. Okay, so we use those terms interchangeably, right? And as a matter of fact, look, medullary bone, not only is it called spongy bone, it's also called cancellous. Sometimes it's called trabecular because of all those little bony plates in there. And in a flat bone, sometimes we call it diploid. Okay, so different kinds of bone could be any of these different names right here. All right, so we got the ends of the bone. We got compact versus spongy bone. Here is the large cavity. That's what we call the medullary cavity. And again, it can be filled with one of two different kinds of material. What are those two kinds of material again? Either red marrow or yellow marrow. All right, so since we're all adults in here in our long bones, it's pretty much yellow marrow. We have only a few bones that still are hematopoietic. All right, so now let's look at compact bone. All right, and what do we see in compact bone over here? Oh, you know, there's one last detail. I see a line right here, kind of a solid line right here. We call that the epiphyseal line. And this is the region where a bone grows in length, right here, and there is a corresponding epiphyseal line in the distal epiphysis as well. So a long bone will grow in length from these two areas. And this area before puberty is made out of cartilage, like hyaline cartilage. All right, so what do you think is a tougher tissue? the bone. What kind of tissue is bone like we have up over here? That is? That's osseous connective tissue or bone connective tissue, right? That's very, very tough. And what kind of tissue is in this epiphyseal plate when it's growing? It's cartilage, right? And what kind of tissue do you think is stronger, bone or cartilage? Bone is certainly a lot stronger. So that if we apply compression to this bone, axial compression from epiphysis to epiphysis over here, and the bone becomes compressed, right? Guess what tissue is more easily damaged, the bone itself or this epiphyseal plate? Yeah, the epiphyseal plate, because it's only made out of cartilage, right? So a lot of times when little kids are horsing around, I know when I was a kid, I'd like, probably even still today, I like to get on a swing and do what? Swing back and forth and see how high you can get up in the air, right? And then what's really fun, when you get really high in the air, well, then you jump off, right? And you go flying through the air. That's great. Except what? Well, you got to land, okay? And there's a lot of axial compression to bones. And sometimes when kids do that, right, they can damage this epiphyseal plate. Now, what happens when this epiphyseal plate is damaged? Then that bone doesn't grow anymore from that particular location, which is really kind of terrible. And maybe you damage one leg but not the other, so what does that mean? One leg is going to be shorter than the other, and then as you grow up, you need shoes that kind of compensate for that. You need a lift in a shoe, right? So you got to be really careful with youngsters that they don't damage these epiphyseal plates. And there's another group of people. Yeah? Wow, bone stimulation. I don't know. It depends. There's probably many different kinds. Bone stimulation could be hooking electricity up to a bone, putting a current through the bone, and that has a tendency to deposit calcium in the bone that makes it stronger. Okay, and it could be at this epiphyseal plate, or it could be anywhere along the bone over here. So because calcium and phosphate actually form like crystals in here, crystals have special electrical properties. And so if we put current through a bone, that will have a tendency to make it grow because of that. Or if you have a bone or a crystal and you compress it, that will produce an electric current. The opposite will happen. Call that a piezoelectric effect. And some loudspeakers use that effect. They have crystals. When electricity gets passed through it, those crystals vibrate, and that produces a sound that people use for making loudspeakers. All right, so I don't think it's a direct effect on this epiphyseal plate more than it's an effect directly on the crystalline structure of bone. Okay, it helps the deposition of calcium into the bone because of a piezoelectric effect. Okay. But you know, there's another group of people that can damage these epiphyseal plates pretty easily because we've talked about compression, but also in that area it's very susceptible to torsion or twisting stresses right before it comes bone. And I know people, for instance, if they're young, before puberty, if they're throwing baseballs or softballs, especially baseballs, if they try to put a lot of spin on a baseball, what do you have to do to your arm to get spin on a baseball? You got to twist your forearm very rapidly, maybe violently, and that can damage these epiphyseal plates as well. So youngsters in Little League are taught not to throw these fancy kinds of curveballs and sliders and things like that that require a lot of twisting. They said, well, if you want to throw fast, that's okay. If you want to throw a fastball, that's fine, because what kind of ball is that? That's just straight throwing hard. That doesn't produce a lot of twisting on the bones of your arm, and that protects these epiphyseal plates. So epiphyseal plates are these growth centers that are what? Relatively weak compared to the rest of the bones, long bones that we have in our body. All right, so let's look at some cortical bone. You can kind of see what it looks like underneath the microscope here, right? But here is, here is a picture of a flat bone with a trabecular spongy bone. We call that diploe. And a flat bone, for instance, a flat bone that makes up the skull right here. This is what I wanted to look at. All right, so you're familiar with this picture right here. What kind of tissue is this? That's bone, right? Kind of, you see all of these rings? So bone resists compression because it's built of tubes inside tubes inside tubes inside tubes. And if you want to have any kind of structure that won't compress, it really should be made out of a tube, like bicycle frames are made out of tubes, chair legs, you don't want to compress and fall apart when you sit down on a chair, so they're made out of tubes, for instance. So tubular structures are very, very strong. So what we're going to look at right now is the structural and functional unit of compact bone. All right, so if you understand the structural and functional unit, you pretty much understand everything about how bone is made to be strong. And the structural and functional unit of compact bone is what we call an osteon. And another name is haversion system. So here is one osteon. Guess what we have over here? Another osteon. And here I see another one, and another one, and another one. Okay. So an osteon is made up of a bunch of these tubes, but with these tubes we just call lamellae, right? Different layers. And this is where the calcium phosphate is deposited by these cells. What do we call these cells in mature bone? These are, you probably should know this for the practicum, these are osteocytes, right? Osteocytes inside these little bubbles of bone that are called, got to know this for the practicum too, these are lacunae, right? Lacunae. And one is a lacuna. So here is a lacuna. And so here are the different layers. And in between the layers, there are also collagen fibers between the lamellae. All right, so an osteon has a number of concentric lamellae. Maybe I'll put that on the board. Concentric. Concentric lamellae, right, that make up all these tubular structures that make up an osteon. And then, what is surrounding all of the osteons in compact bone? Even more tubes, right? So bone is tubes with inside tubes, which is inside what? More tubes that have more tubes. So bone is extremely strong. These lamellae over here aren't called concentric. These are called circumferential. These are surrounding the whole bone. But nonetheless, there are still, what, osteocytes and lacunae in this area right here. Now you can see, what can you tell me about the vascularity of bone? Are there blood vessels in bone? Yes, all over the place. That's good and bad. The bad thing is, if you fracture a bone, guess what's going to happen? You're going to have hemorrhage. And it could be a severe hemorrhage. And people can die of hemorrhage, blood loss, when they fracture a bone. All right, so it's good to have good hospital care close by if you ever fracture a bone. But what is the good thing about having bone being highly vascular? Once it's broken, what's going to happen to it? It's going to repair relatively quickly because it has nutrients and it has oxygen. So that's one of the nice things about repair of bone. It's relatively rapid, maybe 4 to 6 weeks. And if it's treated right in that process of healing, the bone probably will even be stronger than before when it was broken, okay, because of that vascular supply. So this central canal within an osteon is called the central canal. Sometimes it's called the haversion canal. But there are also transverse canals, all right, which we call perforating canals, right, or Volkmann's canals. So there are blood vessels going everywhere in bone. So bone is indeed a living tissue. And I think I mentioned this before, way back when. Now the bones you have in your body certainly aren't the bones that you had when you were born. And as a matter of fact, how often does your skeleton completely rebuild itself? I think I mentioned this, every 5 years. So these cells are busy building new bone and getting rid of old bone all the time. So your skeletal system is very dynamic. All right, so that's what I want you to know. Oh, one last thing. Material can't diffuse through this solid bone that's made out of calcium phosphate. All right, so there have to be little channels that allow for nutrients and oxygen to diffuse between the different lacunae from the capillaries, right, to get to these cells. And these little canals are called canaliculi. That's plural. One is a canaliculus. All right, so that just allows oxygen and nutrients to get to all of these living cells throughout the bone. Right? Because this compact bone is too solid for material to run through. All right, here's another good picture that shows the lamellae of compact bone. What's another name for compact bone? Compact bone is cortical bone, right? That's on the superficial part of a bone. All right, so here are the different lamellae, and these dark lines right here represent collagen fibers. All right, now don't forget, collagen fibers don't stretch. So bone has got two major kinds of components associated with it. It has some organic components that are these collagen fibers. Right, your body builds collagen. And collagen is important because it resists twisting motions, which we call torsion. And collagen resists what? Stretching, which is what we call tension. So that's what's really important about collagen. But what else does bone resist? Bone resists compression. And that's due to a totally different kind of compound. It's not collagen. That's the hydroxyapatite. That's the calcium and phosphate matrix of bone resists compression. And that's the inorganic part of bone, right? Calcium and phosphate are inorganic materials. So in bone, you have organic materials and inorganic materials. The organic material makes collagen that resists stretching and torsion. The inorganic material, which is hydroxyapatite, resists compression. So now you have a material that does what? It resists compression, it resists twisting, and it resists stretching as well. So it does a marvelous job at doing all of those. So, and notice that in every lamellae, the collagen fibers have a different orientation. They're perpendicular to each other. What does that remind you of? That gives additional strength to the bone from stretching and twisting because of the different orientation of these fibers. Where have you seen that before? Nobody's seen that before? Like when you buy a piece of plywood, for instance, that's made up of different layers of wood. What can you tell me about the grain in the wood when you have plywood? Is it all lined up the same? It wouldn't, because then it would fracture, right? The grain is always 90 degrees to each other within the different layers, and that makes plywood extremely strong. And tires have belts in them, and the belts and tires are what? Oriented in different directions that make it very strong. So there's a lot of engineering that has relied on stuff that we know about anatomy, right? So you can apply anatomy to many different kinds of fields as well. Okay, so that's the chemical composition of bone. All right, so you learned of a cell that we find in mature bone. What's the name of that cell? That's an osteocyte. But we said that bone turns over in your body every 5 years. So that means that bone has to be dissolved all the time, as well as bone has to be produced all the time. So we need two other kinds of cells in order to understand bone. Right? There are cells that break bone down all the time, and they are called osteo, standing for bone, clasts. Osteoclasts break bone down all the time. And the other kind of cell that is working is an osteoblast. Alright, so since your skeleton hasn't totally dissolved away, you have osteoclasts that are breaking bone down. You also have to have what kind of cells that build bone up? Osteoblasts. Okay. So what can you tell me about the activity of osteoblasts and osteoclasts? What's the activity? What's the relationship between these two cell types? Yeah, they're working in opposite directions, right? They work in opposition to each other. And that's a real important point in this class, right? And how our body regulates and maintains itself is through antagonistic mechanisms. So osteoclasts and osteoblasts work in opposition to each other. They're antagonistic. And what is your idea of something that's of antagonism? Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah, generally speaking, you think, well, it's kind of a bad, negative thing. Who wants to be around antagonistic people all the time? But in terms of control systems and how your body controls and regulates itself, it's a very, very good thing. So in terms of control theory, it's very good to have antagonistic mechanisms, because when you have two mechanisms that are antagonistic to each other, your body has precise control and balance of what's happening inside your body. So a really good example of antagonistic mechanisms that provide precise control and balance, I would use your automobile as an example. Can you tell me two mechanisms that you have in your car that you would never consider driving unless both of them were working and functioning, but nonetheless they work in opposition to each other? And that is what? The brake and the gas pedal, right? So that's an example of two antagonistic mechanisms that allow you to have precise control and balance of your car. If you only had a gas pedal after work tonight, you could get home, right? You could step on the gas pedal and get home. But once you got home, what would happen? Well, you just have to wave goodbye because you couldn't stop. Right? So antagonistic mechanisms are really important. All right, so that's why I like to talk about these osteoblasts and osteoclasts, because when they are in balance with each other, you have a healthy skeleton. But as we get older, guess which one gets to be a little bit more active? Your body loses balance. Yeah, the osteoclasts become a little bit more active, and as we get older, we have a tendency to lose bone mass. What do we call that disease process? That's called osteoporosis, right? Osteoporosis. So we're always trying to figure out ways to reestablish that balance. And indeed, that's really the point of all medicine, is how to treat somebody so that their own body can really heal itself and find that balance, right? Regain that balance. And osteoporosis is kind of an interesting disease process because, for instance, there's a flu going around right now called swine flu. Okay, and it might be really bad for some people, but will everybody in here come down with swine flu? You know, maybe 90% of us will, maybe not, hopefully not. But you know what? It's really rare for a disease process to affect every single person in a population. Why do you think that is? Why is it strange that a disease process affects everybody? Because we're a diverse population. Okay, we'll see why that is in the very last chapter of the anatomy class. So we're diverse, so we're not all going to come down with, say, swine flu. But you know what? If we're lucky enough to live old enough, guess what we're all going to come down with? Osteoporosis, to one degree or another, right? Males and females. Females are a little bit more susceptible to bone loss because what are their bones typically compared to a male skeleton? They have a slighter skeleton. So as soon as they start to lose a little bit of bone, it becomes clinically relevant. When men lose bone, since their bones are thicker to begin with, they can afford to lose some. So osteoporosis is not so significant for them, but even males will lose bone mass as they get older. So osteoporosis is a real interesting kind of pathology because it affects everybody. But now, how do you protect yourself from osteoporosis? And this is the reason why everybody hates anatomy and physiology. How can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Okay. It is diet and exercise, just like what's good for almost everything else. Your diet has to have what? Calcium and phosphate and vitamin D so that you can absorb those materials. But if you don't do something else, you'll lose that calcium anyway. What is that other thing that you have to do? You've got to exercise. Right, to maintain strong bones, because your bones are being rebuilt all the time. And I will make one other point, and that is, let's compare that to a muscle. All right, so here I have a nice biceps brachii in my arm, and if I were to walk around all day long curling a 5-pound weight, what would happen to that biceps brachii? Would it be the same in 2 weeks? No, it would do what? It would get bigger and stronger, all right, because of that exercise. And you know what? Every part of your body responds to stress pretty much the same way. So if you have a bone and you stress a bone by exercise, guess what happens to that bone? Just like that biceps brachii, it gets bigger and stronger as a result of that. All right? So your bones get bigger and stronger when you exercise, that protects you against osteoporosis, especially women. And diet and exercise is important premenopausally, before you start to lose bone mass. All right, so that's how you protect yourself against osteoporosis, especially if you're a woman with a very slight skeletal frame to begin with. Okay, so we'll start here on Wednesday. Bone formation and growth. All right, don't forget the sign-in sheet. And thanks for staying the whole class period. That's really good.